You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
I would treat Vladimir Putin firmly, but there's nothing I can think of that I'd rather do than have Russia friendly as opposed to the way they are right now.
Well, yes, but is cozying up to Vladimir Putin in an undisclosed post-dinner chat really the way to interact with a man accused of meddling in the very fabric of US democracy? My guests Alistair Bunkle and Phil Clark will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the beginning of Montenegro's trial of the century. The competition is admittedly not that stiff, but still. Rwandan President Paul Kagame's declaration of victory in an election which has not yet occurred, and Gibraltar adds itself to the long list of Brexit consequences that someone should probably have thought about in advance. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Alistair Bunkle, defence correspondent at Sky News, and Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS. Welcome both. And we will start by tugging once again on one of the uncountable threads dangling from the rich tapestry of US President Donald Trump's relationship with the Kremlin. In keeping with a now established tradition of admitting to all pertinent interactions in installments, the White House has today confirmed that at the other week's G20 summit, Trump held a second and previously undisclosed meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. This second meeting, lasting an hour or so, was an informal encounter, around the group dinner. Alistair, is it weird that we've only just found out about this?
In normal circumstances, I think you have to accept that leaders should be allowed to and do have meetings that are private.
Normal circumstances seems like a thing that happened a long time ago.
Normal circumstances is my caveat to all of those. In normal circumstances, I see no problem with two world leaders being able to meet privately and discuss whatever issues they want to do. In normal circumstances, when the United States and Russia are not on best of terms, I would advocate that the two presidents meeting and having some sort of dialogue and some sort of working relationship is a good thing, as opposed to sort of hurling rocks from each other's countries. These aren't normal circumstances. Whether or not there is any truth behind the allegations linking Donald Trump to Russia, at the very least, Trump must have realised that the imagery of this is not that wise, and it's either naivety or arrogance that he felt he could sit in a room with the rest of the G20's leaders and go off into a corner for an hour with President Putin and nobody would notice.
Phil, we don't know what they talked about. We do know that the only interpreter present was Putin's. We also do know that Vladimir Putin's English is not that bad. In fact, it's probably not even that cheap a joke to suggest that it's better than Donald Trump's. Is there a genuine concern, though, that in this particular battle of wits, i.e. that between Putin and Trump, the forces are perhaps not evenly matched?
I think that's a serious concern here. And in the context of the G20, I mean, Trump's best ally seems to be Putin, and Putin seems to have a profound strategic advantage over Trump thus far. I think if we look at Putin's actions throughout this controversy with the US over the last 6 or 7 months, he seems to have played it perfectly. He's appeared very wise, cunning, quiet, strategic in the background, while Trump is the one kind of flailing around. I think the translator thing strikes me as significant in that it suggests this meeting was kind of thrown together quite quickly, that these are, you know, kind of two leaders who sort of decided on the fly that they needed to talk. And I think that would be worrying in and of itself as well. Trump, for all of his bluster, actually strikes me as someone who needs to do a lot of preparation, and in fact does do quite a lot of preparation. And so in a situation of a very quickly organized meeting, again, I think the advantage very strongly would be with Putin.
Alistair, that strategic advantage that Phil mentions, this is, of course, the 64,000 ruble question. Do we yet understand what it actually is? What is it that Putin has over Trump? Trump has always been extremely reluctant to criticize him. He seemed extremely reluctant to oppose him. Is it perhaps just as simple as that slight overawed fondness that Trump clearly has for the macho strongman type. Would you see at home in you know his deference to generals?
The two things I'd say to this is, firstly, I've never known whether or not Putin has anything over Trump. We don't know that. We don't know whether they've got any compromat. My personal belief was that the Russian meddling in the US election was just to cause disruption, and it went their way in the most spectacular fashions, and Donald Trump was elected president.
This has always struck me as plausible as well, that Russia just thought, let's screw with America because we can.
Yeah, and my word, look what's happening. We've suddenly got this guy as president. Strategically now, of course, with President Putin wanting to have his way in Syria, wanting to have his way in Ukraine, and wanting to still exert influence over various countries which Russia sees within its sphere, of course, what he wants is a US president who is not going to stand in his way. And so I think anything that he is trying to do is trying to make sure that he can act as much as possible with free will.
Phil, just one more thought on this one, because there will doubtless be plenty more where this came from. We also found out over the weekend about the eighth person at the Donald Trump Jr. meeting. This was Irakli Kavaladze, a flunky of Aras Agalarov. Is it still believable that this meeting, again, the details of which were rather bizarrely drip-fed, was the only contact at all that occurred between Russian emissaries and the campaign, and that absolutely nothing ever came of any of it, and it was never spoken of again?
Seems completely implausible. And I think this is why that the Trump camp is spinning as badly as they are at the moment, and it's why the US press has smelled blood. They think that, well, if this meeting, as supposedly innocuous as it was, has been so systematically covered up, there must be more here. And I think this is only giving even more momentum to the six or seven different Senate inquiries going on in the US at the moment about the direct involvement between Russia and the Trump campaign leading up to the election. So, yeah, there's legs to this story yet.
Okay, well, let's move along slightly to another case of alleged Russian meddling in the affairs of a Western democracy. The tiny Balkan state of Montenegro is agog at the beginning today of what is being locally described as the trial of the century. And in local terms, this does seem a plausible claim. Two opposition politicians, Andrija Mandić and Milan Nezevic, face the beak on terrorism charges linked to an alleged plot orchestrated from Moscow to overthrow Montenegro's government on election day last October. 14 people in total have been charged, including two Russian nationals who are being tried in absentia. Alistair, I know you've been following this story very closely. Briefly, the plot itself, the October revolution, if you will, how was it supposed to have worked?
Election night. You have a pro-European government and a pro-European president in Montenegro. Russia sees Montenegro in its sphere of influence as it does the remainder of the Balkans.
And Montenegro had not yet joined NATO, of course.
Not quite, but was on the path to doing so and has now officially joined NATO. Outside parliament in Podgorica, a pro-Russian protest against the incumbent and most likely the successful government in that night's elections. In that, some Serbian plotters mix dressed as policemen. They go into parliament and they turn their guns on this Russian crowd, pro-Russian crowd, and fire upon them, making it look as though the pro-European government forces have fired upon the pro-Russian supporters, thereby dividing the country. In conjunction with that, there was a separate plot. Well, it was obviously aligned, but a separate plot to assassinate the president as well. This was all uncovered at the last minute, and two Russian GRUs, the military intelligence agents, are behind it. A guy called Eduard Shishmakov and Vladimir Popov. They're now in Russia, as you say, they've been tried in absentia. But we uncovered, some of my reporting uncovered a link that proves their connection both to Moscow and to the Russian military. And so what this trial is going to try and do is prove that Russia was behind this attempted coup.
Just to follow that up, Alistair, it is a fantastically complicated, risky plot which could have had ramifications far beyond Montenegro. Why is Russia so exercised about the prospect of Montenegro joining NATO? Montenegro has a standing military of slightly over 2,000 soldiers. For point of comparison, the Metropolitan Police has 33,000 officers.
Yeah, no, fair point, but I could equally just turn that on its head and say NATO wants Montenegro to be a member regardless of those small figures as well. So if NATO wants Montenegro part of its sphere, likewise Russia. Why does Russia want Montenegro, this tiny country? Partly geography, it's slap bang pretty much in the middle of the Mediterranean, but also there's a port there in Kota Bay, and it's a deep water port. They can bring their ships in there if they had a friendly Montenegrin government, and they can refuel in the middle of the Mediterranean, something that they know they currently don't possess. So if Russian ships outside of the Black Sea want to refuel, the only place they can do it is Syria, which incidentally is an offshoot, is one reason why they want a strategic foothold in Syria. But they wanted Montenegro to remain within their sphere of influence in the way that someone like Serbia as a neighbour does.
Serbia, of course, is unhelpfully landlocked. Phil, is this of a pattern with what we've seen from Russia in Georgia, Ukraine, elsewhere? Are they meddling with a particular strategic purpose in mind? And Alistair points out that, yes, an Adriatic port would be a desirable thing to have. Or are they just meddling because it's what Russia does?
I think certainly that there's a strategic element here, but also I think that there is a sort of desire for grandeur, and Putin likes this sort of performative politics. He likes these grand statements of being able to maintain the sphere of influence, as Alistair says, to be able to project a sense of Russian glory back to the Russian population, and to be able to say, look, you know, we are still a vital global player with power and influence. So I think that's why these, you know, these sort of frontier states and the continuing Russian meddling, you know, really, really matters in terms of Russian domestic politics. I think what is quite remarkable in this case, though, is the brazenness of the plot in broad daylight in the context of a national election with, you know, some extent of international media covering what was happening in Montenegro. And yet, you have a plot that is so out in the open, but also largely ham-fisted. I mean, the fact that it was sort of dismantled as quickly as it was suggested this wasn't the best orchestrated plot going around. So, you know, some really stunning elements of this case.
Alistair, Russia, of course, is denying everything, but they would have done that had the plot actually worked more or less as planned, wouldn't they? This is just what Russia does.
Yes, of course. I mean, Russia is, although the two Russian agents are being represented in court. And, I mean, incidentally, actually, the trial opened today and quite quickly was postponed until tomorrow because the defence are trying to claim that the prosecutor is in some way discredited. I think Phil just used the two words I'd use. Yeah, brazen, absolutely. But also bear in mind, at the time, October of last year, this was one of the first sort of examples we'd had around that sort of time of Russian foreign policy failure, because actually at the time Putin was doing pretty well in places like Syria, and this was not according to plan. And I imagine these GRU agents will be pensioned off and live somewhere peacefully in Russia, but they did not perform their task, I think, as they were directed to do so.
Phil, are we likely to see much more of this sort of thing in countries which have not yet joined NATO and which Russia would prefer to think of as part of that sphere of influence? I guess Serbia, Macedonia seem the obvious candidates.
It would at least give pause for thought to the leaders of those countries. And I think that's, again, the symbolic significance of this Montenegrin case is, even though it seems to have been disorganized and broken apart quite quickly, the fact that it happened at all, I think, showed Russia's intentions. It sent a message to those other frontier states that may be thinking about joining NATO. So I think that's extremely meaningful in that sense.
Just a final thought on this one, Alistair. Is it I don't know if endorsement's the right word, but is it an acknowledgement of Russia, this desperation to stop Montenegro joining NATO? And it seems fairly clear that this certainly underpinned their intervention in Georgia, that they didn't want Georgia to join NATO, and it must have been part of what they were thinking about Ukraine. That Russia does still acknowledge that, however sprawling, unwieldy, and occasionally dysfunctional NATO becomes, once somebody is inside NATO, it is hands-off.
Yeah, I think so, because one would not be surprised if, having successfully joined NATO, Montenegro then looks to join the EU. And I think those two memberships can sometimes go hand in hand, not always, but can sometimes go hand in hand. I say not always. I mean, look at someone like Turkey, for example. But yeah, you are essentially turning yourself politically and ideologically towards the West. And militarily, you're turning your back on Russia. And the fact that Russia and Moscow felt able to do this in a European country where if you stand on the shores of Montenegro, you can see Italy in the distance on a clear day, right in the middle of Europe, just shows the confidence they had at the time.
I think the other angle on all of this is perhaps not so Russia-centric, although I think that's obviously unavoidable. But I think this also would have to be seen in the context of Balkans politics, that there's clearly a sort of an independent Serbian component to this Montenegrin case, with Russia's in the background, but some of the suspects who are being prosecuted are Serbian. And I think, again, it shows that the inability of the Serb government to come to terms with the breakup of the former Yugoslavia and what it sees as its increasingly subservient place within sort of wider Balkans politics. I mean, I think that this is a part of the world that obviously exercised everybody in the 1990s, journalists, academics, all the rest of it. You know, a lot of people have taken their eyes off it. But this is a deeply unstable, volatile part of the world with an enormous amount of violence going on. So I think we would also need to see it within that framework.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Alistair Bunkle and Phil Clark. Coming up next, why nowhere in Rwanda will be opening late to watch the election results come in.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Phil Clark and Alistair Bunkle. Now, all politicians like to project an air of confidence while campaigning. Rwandan President Paul Kagame has, however, taken this to a new level by effectively declaring victory in next month's presidential election more than a fortnight before ballots are cast. Kagame has suggested that this election was effectively run and won back in 2015, when Rwandans approved almost unanimously a constitutional amendment that would allow him to stand for a third term. Mr. Kagame has been president since 2000 and has effectively governed Rwanda since 1994. The way is now clear for him to remain in office until 2034 at least. Phil, we have seen some startling election results around the world this last couple of years. Any value in a punt on an upset here?
Yeah, I mean, this is Rwanda's great gift to international politics, I think, is a sense of stability and continuity in these very uncertain, volatile times. So maybe we should be grateful for that. I mean, even by Kagame's standards, that this is quite remarkable for him to announce a month in advance that he's going to win. I mean, what's interesting this time around in Rwanda is just how organized the state has been. I mean, they're always pretty good at orchestrating these electoral victories, but this time they really have been very careful in that not only was there a referendum 2 years ago to change the constitution to allow Kagame to run for this third term, but there was also a government-orchestrated petition to the government to have the referendum, and that also got 4 million signatures, which is about 90% of the adult voting population. So, in fact, the vote this year will be the third phase of this entire process. So you start to understand why Kagame is as confident as he is of victory on the 4th of August.
Just to follow that up, Phil, you know, on the credit where it's due front, Kagame did, of course, halt the genocide in 1994. He did subsequently reassemble a country which looked as hopelessly broken as any country ever has. These astonishing numbers he racks up in polls, petitions, elections, etc., do they reflect genuine enthusiasm for him?
So this is the great paradox, I think, of Kagame's government, which is that across the ethnic divide, he's actually more popular than a lot of people outside the country recognize. One of the big reasons for that is the level of socioeconomic development. Hutu, Tutsi, Twa, it doesn't matter. Your life in rural Rwanda is infinitely better today than it was 20, 30 years ago. So he's popular for that reason, and he and his party would win these elections, I think, quite comfortably without the kind of draconian tactics that we see. But what's interesting, I think, with the Rwandan Patriotic Front, Kagame's party, and it's similar to lots of other rebel movements that have become governments in Africa, is that they don't like to take any chances whatsoever. And so that's why we've seen the dismantling of the opposition, the suppression of open debate and journalism and all the rest of it to absolutely guarantee that Kagame will win a landslide.
Alistair, has Kagame effectively sold Rwanda and I guess the wider world, which gives him a degree of latitude not often extended anymore to your president-for-life potentate types, has he sold this idea that Rwanda has a choice between him and genocide?
Well, I mean, I should say I'm entirely sort of in Phil's hands on this because he knows a lot more about Rwanda than I do. But I find Kagame fascinating. He's a paradox. But this man who has come in post-genocide and managed to create, on the face of it, a very stable country where plastic bags are banned, the streets are clean.
Trains run on time.
Salaries have gone up. They no longer rely as heavily as they used to do on international donations. And yet, at the same time, there is talk of fear behind keeping him in power. In terms of the idea that he looks back at some plebiscite in 2015 and says, well, that's what the country voted for then, so 2 years later it'll be fine. I mean, Jesus, the guy's clearly not looked at British politics, where since 2015 we've had a general election, a Brexit referendum,
remind you of anywhere.
a Prime Minister who's gone, Theresa May holding another election, losing her majority. The only thing I think I can say for sure is that I imagine the opinion polls in Rwanda are better than they are over here.
For him, certainly. Paul, when you look at, and it does get looked at occasionally, I guess what we can think of as the dark side of what Kagame has done in Rwanda, how bad is it in terms of human rights, political freedoms, etc., etc.?
It's a very closed political and social space. There's no question about that. And I mean, part of the reason that even this time we haven't seen the kind of crackdown against opposition political parties and dissenting journalists is that, in fact, there aren't many of them left. You know, Kagame and the RPF have had two previous elections to basically systematically undermine any serious opposition in the country. So, I mean, a lot of commentators have been saying, oh, this is a very peaceful, very stable election campaign in Rwanda. Yes, but the reason for that is what has come before. I mean, it's been such a peaceful and stable build-up this time that, in fact, most international donors won't even be sending election observers to Rwanda this time around. I think it shows a high degree of you know, this is a fait accompli, that the donors kind of know that. The other thing is there are two other very big elections happening nearby. Kenya has elections 4 days later, and Angola's got a vote at the end of August. So the donors, I think, are also having to, you know, sort of spread scarce resources around. But it does say something to the Rwandan government that international observers won't be there. There's a sense of you can orchestrate this kind of vote, you can win a landslide, and to be honest, as long as you keep socioeconomic indicators going pretty well, we don't really care what you do around election time.
I mean, Alistair, just a final thought on this. It's a slightly cynical one, but is that a bad approach for the international community to take to Rwanda? Just to think, look, okay, it's not perfect, he's not perfect, but he's not Colonel Gaddafi. And this, you know, it functions, it's orderly, it works, life is better than it was 30 years ago. Let's leave it alone.
Look, I don't necessarily promote this view, but you say he's not Colonel Gaddafi. There'll be plenty of people who will look back at the 2011 intervention in Libya and indeed what is going on in Syria now and say that both of those countries were more stable under Gaddafi and Bashar al-Assad for all their evils. But again, you have this paradox with Rwanda. It is a place where tourists go and pay big bucks to see the guerrillas. It is a place where international journalists can go and operate relatively freely. It is a place where most of the population are better off having been living under the rule of Paul Kagame. And yet he is it fair to say, Phil, pretty much a dictator in so much that he has no political opposition to speak of, won't allow a political opposition, and there are rumblings of dissent beneath the surface.
And rumblings even within his own party. And I think that's one part of this story that's being sort of overlooked in a lot of the press at the moment, is that not everyone inside the RPF is that happy that Kagame is running again. That there were lots of other leaders within the front who I think by now expected they could have had a shot at the presidency. And so I think that's possibly more important than the lack of opposition politics. It's the internal fractures within the RPF itself.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we'll take a look at Gibraltar, one of the many, many conundrums which languished unaddressed by Brexiteers during last year's EU referendum campaign. The actual inhabitants of the Rock voted Remain by the kind of margin usually associated with Rwandan presidential elections, and for altogether understandable reasons. No Gibraltarian who remembers the Spanish blockade of 1969-82 or any of the subsequent closures of the border required convincing that reducing that border to irrelevance was the easiest route to a quiet life. Alistair, the Chief Minister, Fabian Picardo, has declared that Gibraltar will not, as he put it, be a victim of Brexit. What could Gibraltar being a victim of Brexit look like?
Well, interestingly, most of Gibraltar's trade is with the UK. So in terms of a trade impact, it would probably be relatively negligible. They have a big tourist industry. A lot of those come from Britain as well. The border, as it stands at the moment, is pretty much open. I mean, given that the UK does not sign up to Schengen, it could be a standard border where you go through two checkpoints on your way in and on your way out. That doesn't really happen unless the Spanish are a little bit peed off by something. Essentially, you just get waved through. So I think it is the border that worries them the most. If Spain doesn't like an outcome, it could, and has done in the past, make life very difficult at the border. And they have tens of thousands of people crossing each day to go to work in Gibraltar. So a lot of Gibraltarians live just outside and then commute in. And it can make life very difficult for them.
Phil, do you get the sense that Spain sort of sensed a bit of an opportunity as the results came in on referendum night last year?
I do. I think they've been very strategic in how they've used this. I also think the EU is doing a fair bit of rabble-rousing around the Gibraltar issue. I think they've made threats around possibly giving Spain a veto over Gibraltar's sort of post-Brexit relationship with the European Union. You know, the EU seems to be almost trying to pick Gibraltar off in order to pick a fight with the UK, so to speak. So, yes, I think Spain's using Gibraltar, but the EU's using Gibraltar in all of this.
Alistair, to indulge in a spot of hysterical scaremongering, were push to come to shove over Gibraltar, how far would the UK go to defend it?
The UK recognises Gibraltar's right to sovereignty because Gibraltar has voted, I think, 98 or 99% in favour of staying with the UK in recent years. And the UK respects that in the way it did with the Falklands back in 1982. Having said that, having been to Gibraltar, I was in Gibraltar last week, actually, for work, and I do get the sense that the British governments, past and present, have always slightly treated Gibraltar a little bit badly. You know, you have to go back to Winston Churchill to find the last British Prime Minister to visit Gibraltar.
I was reminded that about 28 times during my own brief visit to Gibraltar, yes.
David Cameron, in fairness, went in 2016, but he went because he was on the Brexit campaign. So he went with an agenda and actually sadly had to fly back within an hour because Joe Cox was murdered. But the point is that Theresa May could go down there to the southern tip of Europe, to British territory, and deliver a big Brexit speech and show support for Gibraltar. Gibraltar feels under threat from Spain daily in naval incursions. It feels under threat from Spain because, as Phil was saying, the EU have put in place the prospect that Spain would have a veto on anything coming out of the Brexit negotiations that would affect Gibraltar. And I think it could do with a bit of an arm around it from the UK. I think if your question was, would we send an armada down there to defend it, one would hope so.
Wouldn't use the word armada in the circumstances, but
a ship, perhaps. But even on that front, the military presence in Gibraltar has decreased dramatically in years.
It still matters, though, doesn't it, as a thing to have, as a strategic hinge point?
Yeah, it does, because, again, like Montenegro, it sits in a very convenient position in the Mediterranean. So British Royal Naval ships, and in the past Americans coming to and from operations in the East, can stop there and refuel, etc. But they do so less and less.
Alistair Bunkle and Phil Clark, thank you both very much for joining us. That brings us to the end of today's show, which was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elisa Maher. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900. Daniel Giacopelli is in with the entrepreneurs. I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.